Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Whoa, 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 whoa. What's going on? Welcome to the worst year ever. I'm going to do it again.
No, Cody.
I was still reacting to the 15 pages you just quoted.
I'm just letting you know, do not cut that, Daniel. That was amazing.
No, in no way. That is our legally mandated only introduction from now on.
You can't redo that, Cody. I'm sorry. There's no editing in podcasting.
Good. I didn't think
there was.
There's no
fucking
editing
now.
In podcasting.
What is this podcast we're doing?
It's called Worst Year Ever. We're the podcast that you're listening to. My name is Cody Johnston. We're going to say our names.
Katie Stoll is mine.
Robert Evans.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Me.
We did it.
Oh, man. We got our names out.
I mistake myself for Katie regularly because I use her driver's license.
Yeah.
So,
that's where it's been.
Yeah.
I've just been, I had to get a fake one off the black market.
You might be in trouble in Nevada.
Okay. Well, you know what? I never go to Nevada. You guys can, if we ever have to go to Nevada for this show, you guys can go without me.
Oh,
just don't use my ID, Robert.
All right. Well.
Also, I pronounce it Nevada. But
now you've made me into some sort of bad guy just because I'm stealing your identity, which
and
I feel
doing...
like is unfair.
No, Robert, not because of that, but because of whatever you've done with my identity to make me barred from Nevada.
Why are you attacking Robert like this?
Nevada.
What the crimes I commit in Nevada are between me and Caesar's Palace.
Tomato, tomato.
ID. Hey, you know what we're going to talk about today?
What?
For the love of God, who?
We're going to talk about Mayor Pete
Buttigieg.
Oh,
Buttigieg. And I'm actually kind of excited about this because I kind of didn't pay much attention to him. And in looking into his history, his views, his whole deal, I'm actually kind of a huge fan of his now.
You're not for serious.
So I mean, I would say I would call myself a Pete Buttigieg.
Yourselves
these days?
Cody.
Yeah.
Cody. No.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No. No, I'm just saying no to the name. I'm ambivalent to Pete.
Nope. I'm a Buttigieg through and through. And so to actually kind of start this out, I wanted to read like a kind of a speech I wrote about him for him.
Oh,
kind
God.
Of like an endorsement. And here we go. I don't know if we can get a little music going. Because I feel very passionate about this.
Maybe air horns? That feels more appropriate for
us. Keep going throughout your talking?
No. In this new century, there are a daunting number of important issues which are to be confronted if we are to progress as a nation. Each must be addressed thoroughly and energetically. But in order to accomplish the collective goals of our society, we must first address how we deal with issues. We must re-examine the psychological and political climate of American politics. As it stands, our future is at risk due to a troubling tendency towards cynicism among voters and elected officials. The successful resolution of every issue before us depends on the fundamental question of public integrity. A new attitude has swept American politics. Candidates have discovered that it is easier to be elected by not offending anyone rather than by impressing the voters. Politicians are rushing for the center, careful not to stick their necks out on issues. Most Democrats shy away from the word liberal like a horrid accusation. Just as film producers shoot different endings and let test audiences select the most pleasing, some candidates run test platforms through sample groups to see which is most likely to win before they speak out on a major issue. This disturbing trend reveals cynicism, a double-sided problem, which is perhaps the greatest threat to the continued success of the American political system. Cynical candidates have developed an ability to outgrow their convictions in order to win power. Cynical citizens have given up on the election process, going to the polls at one of the lowest rates in the democratic world. Such an atmosphere inevitably distances our society from its leadership and is thus a fundamental threat to the principles of democracy. It also calls into question what motivates a run for office. In many cases, apparently, only the desire to occupy it. Fortunately for the political process, there remain a number of committed individuals who are steadfast enough in their beliefs to run for office to benefit their fellow Americans. Such people are willing to eschew political and personal comfort and convenience because they believe they can make a difference. One outstanding and inspiring example of such integrity is the country's only independent congressman, Vermont's Bernie Sanders. I didn't write this about Pete.
Oh, you didn't?
No. This is.
Were you plagiarizing, Cody? Were you trying to pull a Biden?
Yeah, I was Bidening around. This is wowee. So this is the first prize in the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum's Profiles and Courage Essay Contest from 2000 by Pete Buttigieg.
When he was in high school?
When he was in high school.
When he was in high school.
The essay is called Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much more. There's so much more to this this essay of his, and we're gonna get to it. And
it must be so surreal for him to be running against one of his obvious heroes.
Obvious heroes. It's so odd.
I like what he said about how one of the great problems in politics is that candidates just keep running to the middle and focus testing their messages and are terrified to actually take a strong ideological stance because what they really want is to hold the office.
Yeah.
It would really be heartbreaking if the author of that essay did exactly that 18 years later.
It would be such a sad and quick downfall.
I would be so disappointed.
18 short years 18 later, short years. Politicians are rushing for the center, careful not to stick their necks out on issues. Anyway.
I hope this doesn't have anything to do with anything we're going to talk about.
We'll find out.
No, the things that we say on the show usually don't have anything to do with the things that we say on the show, so.
No. So that's that's a fun little essay. There are other essays he wrote during this time period. One is called Rock the Vote, and it's about post-9/11 music, specifically Dave Matthews' solo album, Some Devil, and Radiohead's Hail to the Chief. It's
very
really,
cool.
It's really funny.
Did you find an essay from Pete where he described all of the other people in his high school as ants marching?
No, not quite.
Do you know if he has one of those Dave Matthews Band bumper stickers on his car?
We're going to ask him when he's on this podcast.
He calls them Dave, Katie. Come on.
Okay, the Dave.
Pete's a complicated guy, we're going to come back to his essay a little bit later, probably, but let's get into, like, who he is a little bit.
Great.
Where he comes from. I'm actually just going to sort of list off a bunch of things he's done. This is his resume.
Okay.
And I wonder why I'm saying it like that. Peter Paul Montgomery Buttigieg. That's his full name. Peter Paul Montgomery Buttigieg.
Wow.
I'm sorry. Montgomery? Come on.
Yeah, I know.
But he looks the type.
This is something to take note of, I think. Just listening to those few paragraphs about Bernie, when you listen to what Pete has done, it just really sounds like, you're like kind of a rich white liberal who grew up in the suburbs and went to, you know, you did all the things to do the politics.
He's sounding a lot like, has anybody seen The Politician yet?
No.
Okay, well, it's first three episodes are very good. Anyway, sounds a lot like that. Continue.
Sounds a lot like that, I've heard. Peter Paul Montgomery Buttigieg got his undergraduate degree in history and literature at Harvard University, was president of the Student Advisory Committee of the Harvard Institute of Politics, studied philosophy, politics, and economics at Pembroke College, Oxford, on a Rhodes Scholarship. During college, he interned for Jill Long Thompson's 2002 campaign for a congressional seat. She narrowly lost to a conservative businessman. In 2008, he was her research director for her bid for governor of Indiana. She lost to Republican Mitch Daniels. He did an internship for Ted Kennedy, worked on John Kerry's 2004 campaign trail, campaigned for Obama in 2008, worked on Democrat Joe Donnelly's 2006 congressional campaign. He won. 2004-2005, he worked as the conference director of the Cohen Group, a Washington-based business advisory firm that consults clients on international investment advice. And from 2007 to 2010, he worked for McKinsey & Company, a global management consulting firm. Later, he volunteered for Barack Obama's campaign in 2007. He joined the military in 2007. and was a U.S. Navy Reserve officer from 2009 to 2017. He ran for state treasurer in 2010 as a fiscal conservative. In 2011, at age 29, he was elected mayor of South Bend, reelected once, and is now running for president. Now, we're going to get into a little more detail later, but there's a reason I just sort of listed these off as a resume and why we're now going to talk about 2007 to 2010 when he worked at McKinsey & Company.
Yeah, now, that's been in the news lately.
Yes.
Cody, before we get to that, is there a chance his parents were a fan of the famous folk trio Peter, Paul, and Montgomery?
I was wondering the same thing. Mm-hmm.
There's a chance. Mm-hmm. I haven't found anything. I haven't found any like folk albums. I haven't found like the Buttigieg jug band doing covers or anything.
That was a Peter, Paul, and Mary joke for four people.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes.
Their
big
hit was Pup the Sleeping Pug.
Buttigieg the
I don't know. That was good.
Boy. That was the Irish Rovers, Katie.
Oh, right. I'm getting confused. Yeah. Anyway.
His parents were both professors at Notre Dame, literature and things like that.
Okay.
So McKinsey & Company is a multi-billion dollar management consulting firm formed in 1926. According to a 2004 article in The Independent by Ben Chu, McKinsey's fingerprints can be found at the scene of some of the most spectacular corporate and financial debacles of recent decades. Some of these scandals include, this is just me talking now, some of these scandals include working with ICE, assisting Saudi Arabia in cracking down on dissidents. Mm. They've worked with Saudi Arabia even after Jamal Khashoggi was murdered, dismembered, as we all remember. McKinsey & Company.
And that's why they're in the news lately, right? They've been in the news this week.
They've been in the news a little bit this week. They still attended a major Saudi investment conference in 2018 after this event. They've also worked with the president of Turkey, who we've also discussed on this podcast, I believe. And speaking of Erdogan, Turkey, Jamal Khashoggi, Saudi Arabia, just some quick breaking news. Apparently, it's being reported that Jared Kushner gave the okay to arrest Jamal Khashoggi to Saudi Arabia, and Turkey has intercepted that message and used that to get Donald Trump to remove.
Has that been corroborated by some other places?
Because, the last place I saw it was the Daily Mail, who I am not going to go all in on.
Not all in. The Spectator has reported that with several sources. They're right of center.
Anyway, we'll probably be talking about that on even more news.
It just seemed like a really relevant thing to mention we're saying all these things. But in regards to these scandals, Peter Paul Montgomery has said, quote, "I think they've made a lot of poor choices, especially in the last few years." Buttigieg said on the campaign trail in Iowa recently, "I left about 10 years ago. But it's really frustrating as somebody who worked there to see some of the decisions they've made." These recent scandals aren't the only. They were directly involved in a little company you might remember called Enron.
Oh, yeah.
Quote, McKinsey fully endorsed the dubious accounting methods that caused the company to implode in 2001. This was years before Pete worked there. Because Pete's answer there, in general, is McKinsey speak. Sort of what they specialize in. They're a consulting firm. They do.
What do you mean, Pete's answer there?
Yes, when he talks about it, like, they've made a lot of mistakes.
His answer to talking about the place.
Yeah, and I would argue that his answer to almost everything is McKinsey speak, because they talk around everything. They using phrases like affordable access to sort of obfuscate what they're actually talking about, the illusion of freedom and choice, and so on. Word flourishes that, when you look into them, mean nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So in regards to ICE, I'm going to read this is from a Justin Joff article at PR News about the reaction of the company. In a July 10 all-staff memo, McKinsey's managing director, Kevin Snyder, got out in front of the crisis. He explained that McKinsey was not working with ICE to implement its border activities, but simply providing, quote, management consulting services for the agency's, quote, enforcement and removal operations division.
Say that one more time.
They're not working with ICE to implement its border activities. They're doing management consulting services for their enforcement and removal operations division.
Okay, so they're helping them streamline how to arrest and...
In their enforcement and removal operations.
And removal. Great. Okay.
Well, removal is nice. That's different from like putting people in a camp or deporting them.
It's different.
It's just a removal.
It's like when I remove something I don't want from my house.
Yes.
Yes.
And put it in a camp or send it to El Salvador where it's being hunted.
Right, like right. Hotels. Which is what I do. Yeah,
exactly.
That's what you do.
That's what you do. He also wrote that the company will not, under any circumstances, engage in any work anywhere in the world that advances or assists policies that are at odds with our values. So this is kind of, I think, the crux of Pete Buttigieg. He was here at this company for about 4 years. And if you listen to him talk these days, you see this in everything he says.
Yeah. And it's interesting when he talks about this specifically. I know that he's said like, well, this stuff happened after I'd left. A lot of it happened before.
It was happening before.
So you knew what the company was when you started working there.
Exactly. Reuters actually describes these incidents as indicating not bad apples, but a culture of corruption. And this has been, again, true for a long, long time. It's this approach to society as like this weird, like technocratic, like means based, again, like the test audience sort of thing, like testing, like how do we talk about this approach to what you believe in seems kind of at odds with what he was writing about earlier with in regards to Bernard Sanders. One of the things of this company, they have an up or out policy where consultants who are not promoted are asked to leave. So it's this sort of hyper-competitive arena that fosters that way of thinking all across the way you approach things. And it's why, like, when I was saying, like, here's his resume. These are the things that he can say, oh, I did this, I did this. He actually had McKinsey & Company on his resume when he was running as a fiscal conservative earlier. He no longer talks about it.
Sure, weird. That'd be a bad idea.
Weird, yeah.
He said that the company had the people were good, but there was a culture of corruption. What was the exact wording there? Because that's incredibly weaselly.
Well, so that's how Reuters describes it.
Reuters.
It's not bad apples. It's a culture of corruption.
So it's a bunch of good apples in a box made of poop. Like, how do you have a bunch of good people but the culture's corrupt? I don't understand how.
Exactly.
Oh, what's that show? It's like Bloodline. They're not bad people. They just did bad things.
Right. Well, and right. And like you.
Some of you will get that.
Looking at this company and what they do and how they speak about things, you can say it's a culture of corruption, but you can also say what they're doing is bad. Because if you have a culture of corruption, chances are those align with what the company's goals are, right?
Yeah.
So just the way he distances himself from it, too, is McKinsey & Company through and through. And so I wanted to talk about this company and how they talk to sort of inform.
Or they talk like politicians.
Yes, yeah. Yes, they do, exactly. It's the
so maybe a good training ground for a little politician in training.
Yeah.
Wannabe politician.
Wannabe politician training who used to understand that people hate that. And don't like when people talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you come off as a bit of a fraud when you slowly evolve.
Or at the very least, a hypocrite.
That. At the very least, a hypocrite.
If we go back to earlier in his resume, too, I also noticed that like his first kind of forays into politics were like failing to get a liberal elected against conservative Republicans. And that's after he wrote that essay about Sanders. So it kind of, you can kind of see, I feel like in that him going like, well, I guess maybe it doesn't work going to the left. And if I want to get elected, I have to be able to compete with conservatives on conservative issues.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he joined the military.
Right. I think his entire sort of career from like that essay to now, it's very clear, what he has slowly turned into.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be something that probably young people are turned off by. And it will inform everything we say in the future about him. It's why, you know, because he even went to Harvard when Zuckerberg was there. And we know on Zuckerberg's recommendation, he hired two different people to work for him. His policy director is a former Goldman Sachs VP. So just the entire culture is this technocratic thing that people just like don't like and is very sort of dishonest approach to politics, which I think that a young Buttigieg might have not liked.
Goldman Sachs is the company that's famous for not having anything to do with the 2008 economic crash, right?
That is correct.
They have nothing to do with
that. Yeah, that's what they're best known for. Okay, cool.
And it's just like this like tech bro-y kind of thing too, where like a lot of the things he did as mayor was like smart streets, smart sewers. Like when he talks about, he has a national service program idea, because
mm-hmm.
he served yeah. in the military.
And that's something that I think people tend to
He served in the military.
To. He did. He
Pete
did
Buttigieg.
Indeed. Yeah.
And so he has these ideas for like a climate corps, you know, community improvement corps and these. And he talks about his dream is when people apply for jobs, the first question is, where did you serve and what did you learn? Again, it's this sort of weird obsession with like getting the resume right. Making sure like you've got the right tools, and as opposed to, again, stuff we're going to talk about. But also this national service program, he wants to create a position on the National Security Council to manage these programs.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I don't know why that needs to be on the National Security Council.
I don't know why that needs to be on the National Security Council. I don't know if we should have that, right?
What I can tell you is that Barack Obama back in 2008 vaguely suggested something kind of like this, but less extensive. And the right-wing media ran with it as Obama's trying to build his own secret military, like separate military to like take over the country. And destroy the rest of the military.
Oh my God,
so, if Buttigieg becomes the candidate and pushes this further, I am very excited for how Breitbart's going to cover this.
Well, maybe that's why he would put a position on the National Security Council so that it's not a secret.
What fun that would be.
I don't know. Anyway.
Well, yeah, it's just a weird... it unsettles me, personally, the mm-hmm. National Security Council aspect. And when he talks about this, he has ads called Recruit. We're recruiting you to do this and that.
I'm torn about that, man, yeah. Because like, okay, so my family probably wouldn't exist if FDR hadn't created something vaguely similar, the Civilian Conservation
mm-hmm.
Corps,
yeah.
During the Great Depression, which was hiring a bunch of Americans because there were no jobs. It was the government hiring them and paying them to do stuff like build up all of our national parks. That's where like all of the trails on parks you go through,
yeah.
like were started out and formed from, and a lot of the cabins and stuff. And, I think that especially if we're talking about like a Green New Deal and we actually mean that literally as opposed to like a buzzword,
right.
I can see there being a place for some sort of like national service program where people can like help work on this giant project that is unfucking the environment in some way. So I'm not inherently against every aspect of this idea. The military aspect.
That's
the
it. Fact exactly.
That that's what's a little bit. That's what's off to me because it shouldn't be like military service.
Yeah. When I first started hearing about this, that gave me pause. Wondering what exactly it is. What things that I'm not seeing on the surface here that it might lead to. But at its core, the idea of encouraging people to take this time post high school to, you know, be of service, I think is actually a pretty lovely idea and could maybe help a lot of young people.
It's a lovely idea. And I think it's when you put it through this guy who is fundamentally changed via this sort of corporatist like consulting firm stuff and the military aspect, it warps it into something that I think is unappealing.
Yeah.
At what point are these guys going to get rented out to carry out work on behalf of private corporations and like building mm-hmm. up facilities for private corporations for pennies on the dollar?
Exactly.
Like, at what point is that going to happen? 3 weeks? 4 weeks?
Right. Speaking of corporations, here are advertisements.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together.
From places.
They really
powerful
were.
Ads.
Powerful ads from powerful places. Cody, I'm dying to hear what else you have to say about Pete Buttigieg?
Excuse me?
Katie, that's not fair.
Pete Buttigieg.
How dare you say that in front of a Brodigieg? Okay, so here are more of my thoughts on Pete Buttigieg.
Great.
I'm going to continue my speech. Sanders' courage is evident in the first word he uses to describe himself. Socialist. In a country where communism is still the dirtiest of ideological dirty words, in a climate where even liberalism is considered radical, and socialism is immediately and perhaps willfully confused with communism, a politician dares to call himself a socialist? He does indeed. Here is someone who has looked into his own soul and expressed an ideology, the endorsement of which, in today's political atmosphere, is analogous to a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Even though he has lived through a time in which an admitted socialist could not act in a film, let alone hold a congressional seat, Sanders is not afraid to be candid about his political persuasion.
Very cool. Wasn't his dad a potential Marxist?
There's suspicions of that. If he was a Marxist, he's translated some Marxist writings. People that are asked about that are usually say like, "Well, he never really expressed that kind of politics. I don't think he's a Marxist. He's progressive." So there's no confirmation of that. Okay. It doesn't super matter, probably.
No, it doesn't.
Also, like. His Marxist dad, yeah, we're going to go to Harvard. You're going to do this political thing. You're going to go, you know, you're going to be all the stuff we've talked about doesn't really speak to Pete's ideology. But so in regards to this section of Pete's joyful, resounding endorsement of Bernie Sanders, I'd like to talk quickly about Bernie's opinion of the rise of socialism these days. Pete calls himself a democratic capitalist.
I don't think you need to make that distinction.
And, okay, buddy.
I'm just gonna read this real quick. I think the word socialism is largely lost. This is Pete, Mr. Pete. I think the word socialism has largely lost its meaning in American politics because it has been used by the right to describe pretty much anything they disagree with, to the extent there's a conversation around democratic socialism. Even that seems to be a little squishy in terms of what it actually means. Squishy, Pete. I think of myself as progressive, but I also believe in capitalism. But it has to be democratic capitalism. And this is more McKinsey speak, because if we know what capitalism is, we'd probably say it's people with capital make the decisions and et cetera and so forth. And if you make that democratic, what would that be?
Yeah.
What would it be? What would you call that?
What's a democratic stock market?
I'm trying to think of a good word for that.
I can't. I'm failing.
Well, we could maybe hire a consulting firm like McKinsey & Company.
We could, and we could ask them if they could come up with some branding for us.
Yeah. In this democratic capitalism, if a company, say, we'll call them Fessly, buys up, say, a huge chunk of the nation's water rights and uses them to package up water in tiny plastic bottles that kill the ocean and ship it off all around the world— as drought and whatnot threatens huge chunks of the country where those aquifers are, would we get a vote on whether or not that's okay? Or would the fact that they'd already paid for it mean that none of us has a choice in what happens to that water?
Oh, none of us has a choice.
None of us has a choice.
I think.
Democracy, right?
That's
my definition of democracy. Continue.
So Pete believes in democratic capitalism.
Okay.
Cool.
Because he's a very honest boy. He's also said, I think, much more concerned about the debt than what is fashionable among most people in my party. Side note, Pete, we made up money. We made it up. It's made up. Money doesn't exist. We made it up.
But Cody, the debt's the highest it's ever been. Surely that's had a concrete impact on the lives of the people listening to this.
I don't know, man. We'll have to ask Pete. You want to call Pete? Call Pete, see what he has to say about it.
Yes.
Want to highlight that word fashionable among most people in my party. Uh-huh. That's more McKinsey & Company bullshit. Because it's distancing yourself, but it's also like ingratiating yourself with the ideas. Like, it's not fashionable these days. It's just very weaselly how he talks. And it's...
political.
It's a little political. And to sort of really illustrate this, we're going to talk about a little thing called Medicare for All.
Great.
So Pete Buttigieg, wild Bernie Sanders fan, has discussed Medicare for All in the past. He has been for it. In fact, when someone asked him about this in the past, he has tweeted, this is from February 2018, his response asking about why don't you support Medicare for All? His response was, buh? When, where have you ever heard me oppose Medicare for All?
How does he spell buh?
B-U-H, question mark, yeah.
That's right. That's correct.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah.
His follow-up, gosh! Exclamation point.
At least it wasn't gah!
What a dweeb. Okay, I, Pete Buttigieg, politician, do henceforth and forthwith declare most affirmatively and indubitably unto the ages that I do favor Medicare for all, as I do favor any measure that would help get all Americans covered. Now, if you'll excuse me, potholes await.
Well, I love that firm, bold stance.
Firm, bold stance.
From a couple years ago.
Okay.
From only slightly over a year ago.
From only slightly over a year ago.
People like to talk about this. Our friend Nate Silver, friend of the show, has tried to distance himself a little bit from this, like, oh, he didn't change his mind about Medicare for All. Medicare for All was always a sort of blanket idea of like, hey, we're eventually going to do this kind of thing. It's like a universal healthcare kind of idea. It's not, when you say Medicare for All, you don't mean single payer specifically, which of course is nonsense. There's also an essay by Pete Buttigieg from about a decade ago, quote, "We could finally see a single payer healthcare system that closes the gap between the US and other nations when it comes to medical treatment."
Okay.
And before we get into Pete's current plan, I'd like to quickly go through some healthcare industry donors to Pete Buttigieg in third quarter of 2019.
Interesting.
Oh, I'm sure these are all above board.
These are all about between like $2,000, $6,000. Executives at Decibel Therapeutics, Truman Medical Centers, Ironwood Pharmaceuticals, Aztecs Pharmaceuticals, the director of Anthem.
Blue Cross Blue Shield?
Norton Healthcare.
Surely they support single payer health care.
Surely. You know who else probably does? Pfizer.
Mm-hmm.
If I know Pfizer, they love people having access to health care.
Advent Health, Cello okay. Health, Kaiser Foundation Health Plan. These are just some of the many.
Very cool. Many, we get the idea, I think.
Maybe you get the idea. So here is, according to Pete's website, is Medicare for all who want it. Because health care is a human right. Guarantee universal coverage through Medicare for All Who Want It. The Medicare for All Who Want It public alternative will help America reach universal coverage by providing an affordable insurance option to the currently uninsured. The public alternative will provide the same essential health benefits as those currently available on the marketplaces and ensure that everyone has access to high quality, comprehensive coverage.
Keywords.
I love the word access.
Yes.
It's a good word.
If you cut the word access out, then it would just be saying everybody has high quality healthcare coverage, right?
Mm.
But if you add the word access, I wonder if that changes the meaning of the sentence.
I think you know what, Robert? Good point. I think it does.
It might does.
It
always frustrates me, this conversation, when it comes Medicare for All Who Want It just inherently means not Medicare for all.
Well, yeah.
It just means that people, that just puts us in a situation where a lot of people can't afford it.
I imagine him sitting down with some guy going through the early stages of insulin shock because he can't afford $1,400 a month for his insulin because it costs more than his rent. And being like, do you want healthcare? And the guy saying like, yes, for the love of God, please. And him saying, okay, well, if you want healthcare, it's going to cost you $1,400 a month. Do you have $1,400 a month? No. Ah, well, you didn't want healthcare. You had the access to it. You heard the offer, but you didn't want it. So
you didn't want it enough.
You didn't want it enough.
Yeah. This is an issue that I think other candidates could be a little stronger in communicating. The whole point is of insurance is that healthy people, everybody pays in, you see. Healthy people also pay. Wealthy people also pay. So that the sick people can get that access. And if you have all these private insurance companies that are tied to your employment, and then you have this public option of like, well, if you need it, you have this. That's not going to be a very good plan.
No.
Because the people who have the very good jobs and the good insurance aren't paying into the Medicare. And so that will actually not get to what we want it to be. One interesting sentence also on his website, the plan will automatically enroll individuals in affordable coverage if they are eligible for it. If they are eligible for it. And yet at the very top, it says because healthcare is a human right.
Uh-huh.
If healthcare is a human right.
So what makes you eligible then other than being alive and a human?
Interesting. I guess we'll have to read the fine print. So we have the right to a lawyer.
Yeah.
And there's no eligibility there. You don't have to run through hoops. It's not anything other than you get a lawyer.
Yeah.
And so if you're saying healthcare is a human right, but you're also putting it in this way, maybe you don't actually mean that, Pete.
Maybe you don't actually mean that, Pete.
Maybe you don't actually mean that, Pete. Maybe you learned
a
lot.
Or maybe he has a... what's his definition of human? I feel like nobody's asking that. Maybe he has a very narrow definition of human that starts at a certain income level.
That's a good point.
That is a good
because,
point.
Because, like, we have freedom of speech in the United States for humans, but you're not a human if you put on a mask. Then the police can fire tear gas grenades into your skull. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's sort of like that.
Maybe. You know what? Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. We'll have to ask Pete when he's on this show for sure. So I'd like to play one clip real quick to really fully hear Pete's approach to politics. And just the utter smarm that he oozes when he talks about this issue. He is being asked by George Stephanopoulos, is your main argument against Medicare for All now is that it can't get passed or that it won't work? And here's what Pete Buttigieg has to say about that.
You used to be for broader Medicare for All. You didn't qualify it in any way. Is your main argument against Medicare for All now that it can't get passed or that it won't work?
Look, I think it could very well be the long-run destination, but I think there's got to be some humility in our policy here. Let's put this out there and see if it's really the best plan for everybody. I think it will be the best plan, but I'm not willing to assume that it is the right plan for you out of Washington and order you to take it whether you want to or not. If it's the right plan, then everybody will move to it until it is the single payer. And if it's not the right plan for everybody, then we're going to be really glad we didn't kick some Americans off their private plans. I'm thinking, for example, about a lot of union members who fought and negotiated for good plans they have today. They don't want to have to abandon those plans because Washington tells them they must do that in 4 years or less. It doesn't make sense. And the most important thing is we can get to universal health care coverage without putting America through all of that, without kicking people off their private plans, without disagreements to the tune of $10 or $15 trillion over how much this is going to cost, which is equivalent to the entire GDP of the country. We have a plan that is affordable, that is paid for, and that allows you to choose instead of Washington choosing for you. And it's the boldest thing we will have done to American healthcare in a half century.
Oh, what a politician's answer.
The utter smarm.
Yeah.
Of that, like, the first thing he says is we have to have humility. The last thing he says, it's the boldest plan we can get in half a century.
It's, like, so interesting how... It doesn't even quite make sense. Like, yeah, I think in the long run, this very well could be. But, you know, not if it's for everybody. That's not what they want. So we're going to have to wait and see what people want.
Yes.
And what are you saying?
He's not saying anything. That's the thing with this McKenzie nonsense. You're not actually saying anything. When he talks about humility, what does he mean? Because he's also talking about a bold plan. Also, speaking of humility, you were a mayor for like two times. And now you want to be the president of a country. It's and like
humble.
Very, very humble. There's a phrase that he says at the very beginning. I think it could very well be the long run destination.
Right.
That's so many qualifiers to not actually say anything.
Yeah.
It's not saying anything about what you want. It's not this bold new plan. It's nothing. And he's just a real piece of wonderful politician. As I've said, I am a Broded judge.
You guys want to know how many votes Pete has received in his life that gave him the position that he has? Unless you already...
No, please tell me that.
This, Cody.
I would guess under 10,000 votes.
What?
8,515.
What?
Get
yes,
that man.
On the strength of 8,515.
Get that man. Get him on a ticket.
Talk to me about humility.
No, we have to be fair to Pete, which is that by saying that like the current president had zero votes ever before he became the president. So
sure.
In a different era, you know?
But it is still astounding.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in light of everything we've already talked about and how we've certain essays we've read from Pete.
Yeah.
He's the least bold person. He's an empty vessel, it really seems. That is
he's got a lot of languages.
Got a lot of languages.
I think he's a very intelligent, like everything you're saying paints a picture to me of a very intelligent, very ambitious person who actually does believe things, or at least did at one point, but who believes more than anything else that he should be in office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's clearly, like with Sanders, like that's the whole point. The whole point of Buttigieg's essay on Sanders is that Bernie Sanders is a guy who the things he believes matter more, have always mattered more to him than the political viability of those things, because he just actually believes things. And that's like the whole point he was making about the courage of like identifying as a socialist back when that was even more poisonous than it is now. And everything that we learn about Buttigieg's career is that he doesn't really believe in anything other than he wants to be in power. Like, I'll say, it's not like to the extent where he would do anything. Like, I don't think he would run as a Republican. I don't think he would do what Trump has done and like lean into racism and xenophobia to get elected. He has a conscience. He's not a sociopath. But he clearly, I'm going to guess he's a huge fan of The West Wing. And in fact, I'm almost certain read about him being a fan of The West Wing. And I'm going to guess he's one of the most famous scenes in The West Wing was the president the Democrat president in that show unveiling a banner that was labeled pragmatic idealism. Which I think that's his attitude. It's like, if I can get into office because I'm so intelligent and because I'm so such a decent person, like, I don't have to stand for anything. Me being in office will allow me to do good things.
I mean, I'd say best case scenario, he has these ideals and is more idealistic than we're seeing right now. But his time in office, his time at McKinsey has made him, more a politician, but like I also don't. I think that now we actually are in a unique moment in time where people can be bolder and can say flat out what it is that they want and what we need, and we might be able to harness that momentum and get shit done.
And he has talked about this on the debate stage. He's even said, like, we have the opportunity to do the boldest plans in a generation.
So do it.
And it's just clear he is a sort of empty vessel, but he is intelligent. He's been just like a politician guy. I want to be a politician. That's why we see a lot of CNN pieces on like, he's Obama. He's like Obama now. I want to really quick read this quote from a New York Times piece about that aspect of it, because it is just sort of, he's perceived as intelligent. He plays the piano. This quote, there's just something about him. He's intelligent. When an audience member asked about conditions in Gaza during a campaign stop in Mason City, Mr. Buttigieg began responding in Arabic. The overwhelmingly white audience, largely unaware of what he said, broke into raucous applause. And I think that is just the chefiest kiss.
Very fun. Very fun.
It's exactly what he is.
I'm not going to take a stance, but I'm going to do the thing that would get a cheer if this were an episode of The West Wing.
Exactly. It's all performative. Yeah. He doesn't really believe in much. We don't know what he believes in.
We don't know that, but yeah.
We don't know that. We don't know.
What I do know is that it's time for us to take a quick ad break. So let's do that real quick, and then we'll come back for more Pete Buttigieg. Edges.
Edges.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not.
Welcome back to the show, fellow Brota judges.
Yeah.
Are we excited?
Pumped, bro. Judges.
Brota judges.
I don't know if I like this.
My butt is on the edge.
Good.
Oh, I like that.
Is it on the edge?
It's on two edges, actually.
Yeah, I'm on the edge of my butt. Continue.
So we're going to continue. We're going to get to some more of Pete's issues. I'd like to return to his essay about Bernie Sanders, because I don't think that Pete necessarily is going to be sticking around. He may be picked as a VP. We'll see. I don't know.
A VP.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Boo to Judge.
To Judge. Okay. Jesus.
But I want to use this opportunity, and I think it's necessary to basically bully Pete and shame him into dropping out of the race and endorsing Bernie Sanders.
Way to be best.
I'm being best, and I think he should be bullied and shamed.
Okay.
For more on this, we're going to go to Pete Buttigieg.
Okay.
After numerous political defeats in his traditionally Republican state, Sanders won the office of mayor of Burlington by 10 votes. A successful and popular mayor, he went on to win Vermont's one congressional seat in 1990. Since then, he has taken many courageous and politically risky stands on issues facing the nation. He has come under fire from various conservative religious groups because of his support for same-sex marriages. His stance on gun control led to NRA-organized media campaigns against him. Sanders has also shown creativity in organizing drug shopping trips to Canada for senior citizens to call attention to inflated drug prices in the United States. He still does this, by the way. This is Cody speaking. He's still doing that. While impressive, Sanders's candor, very nice, Pete, does nice. Not itself represent political courage. The nation is teeming with outspoken radicals in one form or another. Most are sooner called crazy than courageous. It is the second half of Sanders' political role that puts the first half into perspective. He is a powerful force for conciliation and bipartisanship on Capitol Hill. In Profiles in Courage, John F. Kennedy wrote that we should not be too hasty in condemning all compromise as bad morals, for politics and legislation are not matters for inflexible principles or unattainable ideals. It may
that
seem
was a solid JFK and a slightly better Mayor Quimby.
Yeah, I was going for Mayor Quimby.
Did he put that in italicized or something?
He put it in quotes.
Okay. I was trying to say, like, read with this voice.
He didn't say read as John F. Kennedy, but it is a John F. Kennedy quote he put in quotes. A little on the fly there, giving it a go. It may seem strange that someone so steadfast in his principles has a reputation as a peacemaker between divided forces in Washington, but this is what makes Sanders truly remarkable. He represents President Kennedy's ideal of compromises of issues, not of principles. Sanders has used his unique position as the lone independent congressman to help Democrats and Republicans force hearings on the internal structure of the International Monetary Fund, which he sees as excessively powerful and unaccountable. He also succeeded in quietly persuading reluctant Republicans and President Clinton to ban the import of products made by underage workers. It's kind of weird, actually, that that had to be done, right?
Sure. But,
all right. Yep.
Moving on. Sanders drew some criticism from the far left when he chose to grudgingly endorse President Clinton's bids for election and re-election as president. Sanders explained that while he disagreed with many of Clinton's centrist policies, he felt that he was the best option for America's working class. And I'm going to quickly stop here because I think this is kind of interesting. So recently, Pete was at a union meeting in Cedar Rapids. You know how he mentioned, actually, that union members are worried about their private insurance?
Mm-hmm.
That's not super true.
Mm-hmm.
The nurses' union supports it, Medicare for All specifically. Seems like those
that
may
seems
be
like
the
a real important endorsement,
like a real, important
a real telling one.
But he was.
Oh, but what do nurses know about healthcare?
They're just failed doctors.
There you go.
Yeah.
I don't mean that, nurses.
You don't believe that.
I do not believe that.
What if we listen to teachers and nurses on things?
No.
No.
Under no circumstances,
no,
Cody.
No.
They are allowed to teach our children and give us life-saving health care, but we do not listen to them.
No. All right.
Under any circumstances.
Okay.
Shut up and do your job, nurses.
Yeah.
And Cody.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. All right, then. So I actually looked into Bernie's endorsement of Bill Clinton, and I'm not going to read it but it is fucking hilarious. I'm just going to read some real quick quotes.
Bernie's
endorsement of Bill Clinton that he's talking about. In terms of who to support for president, the choice is really not difficult. I am certainly not a big fan of Bill Clinton's politics. As a strong advocate of a single-payer healthcare system, I oppose his convoluted healthcare. He goes on and on. He basically, the entire time, he's saying, without enthusiasm, I've decided to support Bill Clinton for president. Perhaps support is too strong a word. I'm planning no press conferences to push his candidacy and will do no campaigning for him. I will vote for him and make that public. Why? I think that many people do not perceive how truly dangerous the political situation in this country is today. If Bob Dole were to be elected president and Gingrich and the Republicans were to maintain control of Congress, we would see a legislative agenda unlike any in the modern history of this country. He goes on to warn about this. He talks about how he knows these people. He talks to them every day. He knows what they want. And it's more important to support Bill Clinton. Because do I have confidence that Clinton will stand up for the working people of this country, for children, for the elderly, for the folks who are hurting? No, I do not. But a Clinton victory could give us some time to build a movement, to develop a political infrastructure, to protect what needs protecting, and to change the direction of the country.
I hate it when good people are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's...
tie this back in with thing. Pete.
It's not my favorite. So I'm tying this in with Pete because I think that this is a solid endorsement of Pete if he were to get the nomination. But more than anything, I think it shows an understanding of what Republicans want and are, and even back in the day. As we've talked about with Biden, he thinks that Republicans are going to have like this big epiphany and like come to their senses and compromise. Pete has recently said to union members in Cedar Rapids, he genuinely believed President Trump, when he got into office, would pass an infrastructure bill that he promised. And he's surprised that he hasn't yet. And this, I think, is...
What's surprising about that?
What's surprising about that? It's that it's the West Wingism, I think, that Pete still embodies and has, where he doesn't understand really what's going on. He's trying to appeal to everybody instead of having those principles and a bold vision. Because as we read in his essay about Bernie Sanders, he's gotten things done with Republicans as well as Democrats while staying true to his vision. I don't think Pete has that. And it's,
I see.
Just, you know, I thought that was a little relevant and interesting. Something that he had praised in the past and probably wouldn't understand nowadays. Where we are at with Pete now... I want to talk about a story that's sort of developing that we may have heard that Pete is struggling with black voters.
And there's this narrative of that there's a homophobia in the black community. That's why he's lagging.
A memo in his campaign basically saying that like they think that older black voters are too homophobic to vote for Pete. This is mostly based off of one focus group they had.
That's the only one? Reason.
With 24 people, and some of the older black folks were a little uneasy about Pete. And I would posit that perhaps there are better candidates on issues that black voters care about. And perhaps his history.
I was going to say, perhaps it's his history as mayor. And
has something more to do with it.
His relationship with the police and
So he actually fired his city as mayor of their first ever black police chief, Daryl Boykins. There's a federal investigation revealed that South Bend police were illegally recording phone calls of officers. This was done to basically see if there were many racists in the police force and to find corruption and illegal acts from them. Boykins was replaced by two white police chiefs.
Two?
Yeah. He is.
Wait. So he was fired because he instituted the program of recording police officer phone conversations
to look for racism. And catch them.
Boykins was looking for racism and corruption in his police force, and he was fired when that was discovered by Mayor Pete.
And Boykin, the police chief, was illegally recording the phone conversations of his officers.
His officers, yes.
I mean, that sucks to be...
That is a fucking G move. I am not normally pro-cop, but I am definitely pro-cop who illegally records other cops.
Right.
Because that's fucking solid. Solid police work.
I feel like that's a crime, but okay. I agree. I get the point. Like, and... Yeah.
I mean,
I think whether or not it's a crime to me means less than like, was it
morally the right thing to do?
Yeah. Sounds like
I'm same page on that
point.
So I have super no problem with what Boykins did. And actually, the police communications director alleged that the recordings actually captured four senior police officers making racist remarks
and
discussing illegal acts. So perhaps.
Wait, that's so surprising.
Surprising. Although it was. Illegal. Maybe it was not the worst move to find this information. So that's one thing that maybe people have a problem with, and maybe that's more what his the issue is among black voters. Also, white police officer shot Eric Logan, a black man, and after this, Pete met with Black Lives Matter. He did call for a special prosecutor to investigate, but he had these calls with Black Lives Matter activists. And the reaction was not great. They kind of felt like he didn't really care. He was insincere on the calls and felt like he was sort of rushing along, like it was something he had to do. Although the police union criticizes his decision as being politically motivated, so it's kind of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're both accusing him of the same thing.
Yeah. kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't a little bit, sure.
A little bit. And his sort of response is just like, yeah, I messed up. And I think that it's a little disingenuous to frame it as though it's this homophobia when there are actual issues right. with the community that he has in his past.
And that really ties into one of his constant issues, which is just this like this complete failure to be willing to take a bold side.
Yes.
Like it's one of those things, even if the side he'd picked in that had been like going all out for the police, at least it would have been a stance. But like he clearly he wasn't willing to do that.
This disappointing hedging, this unwilling to like, yeah, take a bold stance or like take. When he talks about it, I think he leaves people cold because there's a lack of taking any responsibility or seeming to learn from things that have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're running to be the president of a party that doesn't win without the black vote. Take a stance in favor of Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
What election do you think this is? Do you think you're going to get... like the MAGA hat voting crowd to go for you because you weren't willing to back BLM? Like, what is your strategic decision there, Pete?
Exactly. I don't get it. It's nothing. It's sort of why I wanted to read that the Bill Clinton endorsement from Bernie, because it's at least an understanding of like, this is what the situation is and here's what we need to do. So I'm just going to say that. With Pete, he is a sort of kind of an empty vessel. And his responses to like the Black Lives Matter criticism, things like that, are McKinsey through and through. And he really doesn't really want to talk about his time there. Another program he actually had when he was mayor is called 1,000 Homes in 1,000 Days.
Mm-hmm.
It was this plan to demolish or renovate homes.
Okay.
Buttigieg took note. Later of the fact that many homes within communities of color were the ones demolished.
Interesting. Did they get rebuilt? Mm-hmm. They just got taken away?
Taken away, the demolished homes.
What?
It's
a shame he couldn't have done anything about the way that program was executed.
I wish, you know what he needed to do to fix that?
If only he'd been the mayor.
I think he should have been the president. If he were the president, that would have been taken care of. So I think that there's an element. Pete is the, if we ignore Joe Biden... because I think despite being very popular with older voters, Pete is the DNC candidate.
Well, he certainly, over the course of this election cycle, has tacked to the middle. Like, you've seen him be like, yep, I'll be the young moderate option.
Would you say that politicians are rushing for the center, careful not to stick their necks out on issues?
I would say that one specific politician.
Would you write it down if you were a senior in high school and you wanted to win the John F. Kennedy Profiles in Courage essay contest?
Would.
All right, cool. Just
I bet
sure.
anybody who wrote that in a John F. Kennedy Profiles in Courage essay contest while they were in high school would grow into the kind of person who would never perfectly embody those words and would always take the right stance, even if it wasn't the easy one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I agree with you completely. And this, it's very clear that the DNC wants this man and the media is very into him. You see a lot of headlines recently about Buttigieg being in fourth place, but a strong fourth.
Right.
Buttigieg surging to third place, this kind of inevitability of Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah, there's certainly a narrative happening. It's like they're testing the winds and seeing like, oh, people don't love that Biden guy.
They need somebody else to get in there because they can't have a Sanders or a Warren.
It almost feels like there's also just this idea that the media is hyping up the conflict. I mean, there's conflict, but, you know, like, uh-oh, now this person's coming. Like,
yeah, it's
creating
horse race
the drama,
yeah.
The drama of it for likes and clicks.
Yeah.
And shares and stuff.
And there's just a lot of excitement about maybe perhaps having a long-term goal of Medicare for all, but for now having a glide path. A glide path is a fun little term.
Well, you've
sure
got to have some humility when you're talking about
mm-hmm,
healthcare.
You have to have humility when you're talking about healthcare.
You can't arrogantly insist that people deserve access to life-saving medical treatments.
No.
Well, can't say healthcare is a human right and then actually put forth an actual vision of that being true.
See, my job as a leader is not to lead. It's to let people figure it out.
We talk on The Worst Year Ever about sort of like what's to come. And I think one of the things that we don't, that's not talked about much or considered in terms of the candidate, is how will this person speak around or to Donald Trump? And I'm just not sure if this dweeb from South Bend is up for the task. I think so. I think in terms of the energy we're going to get from Pete is this sort of mealy-mouthed, not committed to much, faux bold McKinsey and Company speak about choice and so on. There's a clip going around that you can see of his campaign getting ready for a rally, and they're teaching everybody this dance. And it's just the dorkiest thing you can imagine. It's you roll around your arms to the left, and you do it to the right, and then you clap. And we're it's really musical theater high school stuff.
Right.
It's very reminiscent of, there's a clip you can see from the 1996 DNC.
Oh yeah, I retweeted that today.
Yeah. It's all these lanyard dorks doing the Macarena. And it should be pointed out they won. They won that year. You know.
Yep.
But the Macarena was a hit.
Also, it's a different time now.
Yeah.
They were running up against other complete dorks.
I just have a hard time seeing him holding his own next to Donald Trump on stage. You know, in terms of how he comes across energetically. But that's neither here nor there.
It's
going to
be hard.
There's more important stuff, but to consider.
Right. It's they have an ad on his website to enter to win tickets to see Hamilton with my husband.
I know. That's so wild. Why would I want to go with Jastin?
So, you know, I didn't want to get too much into it, every single thing he's done or his platform, because I don't think that matters as much as knowing the kind of politician he is. And so, again, I want to shame him into basically just reading what he wrote in high school and dropping out and supporting Bernie Sanders.
I'd love to have somebody bring it up with him. Like, oh, we found this essay that you wrote in high school all about Bernie Sanders.
And
I think this would be an interesting place to jump off of to talk about your political evolution, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
What do you still believe from this?
It's interesting that a lot of your career is sort of opposed to this essay. So I'm just going to close it out with Pete Buttigieg on his endorsement of Bernie Sanders for president. Sanders' positions on many difficult issues are commendable, but his real impact has been as a reaction to the cynical climate which threatens the effectiveness of the democratic system. His energy, candor, conviction, and ability to bring people together stand against the current of opportunism, moral compromise, and partisanship which runs rampant on the American political scene. He and few others like him have the power to restore principle and leadership in Congress and to win back the faith of a voting public weary and wary of political opportunism. Above all, I commend Bernie Sanders for giving me an answer to those who say American young people see politics as a cesspool of corruption beyond redemption. I have heard that no sensible young person today would want to give his or her life to public service. I can personally assure you, this is untrue.
Well, that is a resounding endorsement of Bernie Sanders that he wrote when he was 18.
Resounding endorsement.
Again, he's convinced me.
I think it speaks to that, Robert, what you were talking about earlier, of like, he just wants to be in office. You know, like, that's what his evolution has sort of happened.
Again, very much like the politician.
Oh.
there's like an aspect of that that's like, that's defensible, because obviously if you don't win office, you can't do anything. And so I am on that side of, it's like, it's better to have a moderate Democrat in there than a literal fascist, because you can push the moderate Democrat to get
absolutely.
Some things done.
Right. That's
At
why,
the same
yeah.
time, I've lived through the last 20 years and I watched a guy, Barack Obama, who was kind of similar in some ways to Buttigieg, but actually took more stances when he was running for president.
Oh, hell yeah,
he was much
did.
Further to the left and still ran right to the center, even the center right, when he actually got into office. And so I'm looking at Buttigieg and I'm going, number one, the fact that Barack Obama ran to the center allowed the Republicans to push this country even further to the right by 2016. And number two, if Buttigieg won't even go as far as Obama did in 2008 to the left, like, we're just going to get pushed by the time, if he wins by 2020, by 2024, we'll be even further right. Like,
exactly.
We can't survive that.
It's hard because I do understand it's hard to get your liberal shit done when we've got so many conservatives in the Senate and Congress. I understand that, but if there's something that we need to have learned from the past, again, 20 years, it's that you have to be bolder and more aggressive, that you can't just be like a mealy, wishy-washy Democrat. Yeah. You have to be bold, and you have to fight really hard, and I don't obviously see that in Pete.
Right, and I think that there's a another lesson from 2016, aside from that, is that above all else, even though he lives in a literal golden tower, there's a very large anti-establishment sentiment that is driving politics these days. And everything Pete says and his entire career is that. His time at McKinsey and Company has taught him how to be that and talk like that. And talk like somebody that you can't really trust.
Yeah, he sounds like a part of the establishment.
There's a deep hunger for authenticity and hunger for a politician who's going to like take a stance. Like Pete knows this to some extent because he quotes JFK constantly. JFK didn't get up there and say, "We choose to go to the moon or wherever." Like, there was a bold and risky and daring stance, which is why we remember JFK. Aside from the getting shot thing, like he was a guy who would take a fucking who would call a shot, and it was a far shot. And Pete Buttigieg is a bunter.
Yes. But also, Pete called his shot a year ago and was very clear about that. And then he, over time, was like, I'll just bunt a little bit. And now we get things like, I think it could very well be the long run destination.
Right.
And having a glide path to this thing that we actually want.
Yeah, the Republicans didn't glide into putting people in camps. They just went for it. And now there's people
in
camps.
Yeah, they parachuted in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
They dropped in there. I'm like, well, now they're in camps.
Well, I guess we've been putting people in camps for a while.
Also true.
And
Yes.
But they sure parachuted it into ramping that up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's time for us to wrap this up. Thanks again, Cody, for doing all that. If you guys would like, and I'd like you to like to do this, check us out online, social media, at Worst Year Pod, you know, on the Twitter and the Instagram. I'm Katie Stoll, online and in life.
I'm Cody Johnston,
I'm Robert Evans. You can find me at I Write Okay, and you can find my friend Cody Johnston at Dr. Mr. Cody.
Okay, well, you guys took care of that very well.
Mm-hmm. It's really weird when you call somebody a dweeb and then you guys do that.
Unbelievable.
I mean, it's more interesting if we did that bit because I'm very clearly not a man, but,
worst year ever. All right.
There's so many pictures of us holding rifles wrong in the desert, too.
I know.
We're all Mayor Pete, and Mayor Pete is America, and that's the message of this episode.
Thanks for listening. I'm Mayor Pete, and I approve this episode.
And Bernie Sanders.
Everything's so dumb, and it's gonna get dumber.
Great. I tried.
Yes.
Daniel.
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.